So at the moment,
last night we listened to Ravel. Ravel was described as an example of impressionism in music. Tonight I'm going to talk about two women painters. This is going to be like a schoolroom lesson in art history, but I might have a few points to make related to the topics I talked about earlier. But I'll get to that. But last night we talked about, we listened to impressionism in music and the piece by Ravel. In the visual arts, impressionism, I think, is quite different from what we heard last night. It's a point of view that attempts to be absolutely objective and detached and impersonal. It's an art form that deals with here one moment and gone the next. It's an art form that tries to seize an instant. It's an art form that's interested in superficial appearances, and in a sense, impressionism is very superficial. It's about surfaces. The impressionists were a movement at the end of the 19th century, in the late 70s and into the 80s, and they tried to work without feeling, without ideas. In a sense, they tried to be mindless and brainless. They wanted to become like a camera, a high-speed camera, and they wanted to see exactly what was there at that instant. Human beings are really incapable of being that detached and objective. And they can't help but have a point of view, and having a point of view really is saying something. But in theory, the Impressionists were not trying to say anything. And they didn't want to cloud the issue with feeling. They just wanted to paint what they saw. I thought the Ravel was far too moving to be called an example of impressionism as I understand it, because I found myself weeping, and I don't think an impressionist painter would like it if he found you weeping. Impressionism tends to be very objective, very positive. It tends to talk about Sunday afternoon in the park when everything is rosy with the world and people are on their best behavior and everything's just right. And that piece last night wasn't that tranquil. So I don't know how musicians use the phrase, but I would use the word expressionistic to talk about certain passages in Ravel. And in the visual arts, we split hairs. We make fine distinctions between impressionism and expressionism. And expressionism is very subjective. One thinks of a painter like Van Gogh, and Van Gogh was interested in the spiritual, in the mysterious. He saw nature as the handiwork of God. He had grand kinds of ideas. He looked at the starry night and he saw it as a manifestation of this omniscient, omnipresent creator. And he had feelings that just overwhelmed him. So Van Gogh could hardly be called an impressionist, and it would be an insult to say he was a superficial person interested in appearances. Painting for him was a matter of survival, and what he saw and what the people he related to went into and became a deep part of his own subjectivity. But that's not my main purpose in being here. I want to talk about Mary Cassatt and Georgia O'Keeffe. But I'm talking about Mary Cassatt at the end of the 19th century in terms of Impressionism, because she was adopted by the Impressionist school in the late 70s and early 80s, and she was included in their exhibits. She's an American woman from Philadelphia, and her father was involved in international business and did a lot of traveling, was sort of an obsessive traveler. And so he took his family to Europe, and they spent a lot of time in the courts of Europe and in the capitals of Europe. He was an aggressive businessman. Her mother was an extremely bookish kind of person, and she liked to go to art museums and read poetry and listen to piano music and all those funny kinds of things. And probably because of her mother, Mary Cassatt developed an interest in the visual arts. Mary Cassatt went to Europe with Thomas Eakins, E-A-K-I-N-S, Eakins. And some of you might know him. He's a Clint Eastwood-type, realistic, tough guy painter, the first president of the Philadelphia Academy of Fine Arts. And he went to Europe, but at the same time as Mary Cassatt, but he really didn't have any truck with this fancy European art stuff. all this Baroque architecture and this Baroque kind of painting, angels and cupids and all those kinds of things. And he came home, and like a kind of a pioneer going out into the West, he started to develop a very realistic point of view, and that's basically American art. American art tends to be very realistic, and I think Aikens is our spiritual father. He's a kind of scientist, very objective, he's camera-like, very accurate in the kinds of things he does. Mary Cassatt stayed in Europe. She liked European art. And she got started copying the old masters. She decided to make a living out of copying great religious paintings and bringing them to the United States to sell them. There was a big market for that. Some of you might know Catholic churches in your communities that have copies of Raphael's Sistine, Madonna, or some of those kinds of paintings. So she made an arrangement with an art dealer in Chicago and arrived there with this truckload of copied masterpieces. And I think fortunately it was 1871 and Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lamp and Chicago burned. And all of her paintings burned. So her life was destroyed. So she went back to France and started over. And she soon attracted the attention of Edgar Degas and Paul Gauguin. And they saw this painting of these two women at the theater. The woman on the right is one of her sisters. And they said, this is powerful stuff. This is very strong. It's very realistic. And they adopted her as one of their legitimate peers in this Impressionist movement. A little bit more biography. Mary Cassatt was the fourth child. The third child died. The fifth and sixth child's children died. And I think there were two more children. And the younger children, the firstborn, had certain kinds of problems. Mary Cassatt ended up being, in a sense, the mother of this family. And she took care of all of these children. She also ended up taking care of her mother. And some of you know what that means, to get involved in that kind of perpetual care of the family. And so she never married herself, but she becomes a very interesting painter of the mother-child relationship. And when you travel through Europe and you look at mother-child paintings or Madonna and Christ paintings, you look at acres and acres and acres of them, and they feel kind of phony. And you come to Mary Cassatt, and although she's not painting Mary and Christ, you feel here is a really strong statement about the relationship of a mother and a child. And in a sense, this girl on the right is one of her children. After the fire in Chicago, she goes back, and suddenly she's very impatient with the old masters, and she's really excited about the avant-garde, about what it means to be a modern artist. And what it meant was to paint with this bright color, to be very realistic, to paint what one sees, to abandon all of this romantic, imaginary subject matter, and to confront life head on. And Mary Cassatt is important for American art because she really is one of the first women to dare to be herself, to dare to just go out and face the world as she encounters it. These are things she learned from Degas. This is a real tearjerker. But she was good at this. She really loved little children. This sad little girl with her straw hat. I could make up some reason why she's sad, but I better stick to my subject here. I put my jackknife underneath the elevation post on that projector. Could you pull that out? Yes, there. This little girl combing her hair, this is a very intimate scene, and a lot of her subject matter involved portraying human beings in these intimate moments where they're getting ready for bed, they're dressing, they're bathing, they're being sad. In the sense of capturing the moment, she is really an impressionist. But it's these kinds of paintings of middle class life, and her own background was upper middle class, or family was well-to-do, they were well-educated. She didn't have to worry about making a living. Her parents provided her with enough income. These paintings, I'm sure as you can see, are very successful. They did sell, and she didn't have a great deal of support. The first day I talked about this vanity image. It's hard to think about this little girl looking in the mirror as an image of vanity. I think it's just a very complicated spatial arrangement of the family reflected in the big mirror and then the girl reflected in the smaller mirror. So it's a powerful spatial complex. But these kinds of things are full of feeling and emotion. She dares to move towards the sentimental, but she has this incredible kind of taste which keeps this from being just a drippy kind of picture about a little child sucking its thumb. She really understood that. But this is something that was denied her. She did not become a mother. She doesn't know this from her own experience, but vicariously, I think, being responsible for her own family, she was able to make these paintings very authentic. People are always touching in her paintings. Mothers touching children, children touching mothers. The paintings are about union, about people coming together, about relationships. In her colleagues' work, Degas, nobody ever touches. Everybody's always apart. They're separate. They're all going their own way. In Seurat's paintings, everybody is unique and autonomous and separate. But Mary Cassatt talks about union, about relationships, about touching, about caring, about loving. And she does this with a great deal of conviction. Maybe one could make some comment about this woman teaching this young child about Adam and Eve, but I don't think that's really appropriate. I think it simply is a mother introducing the child to this world of wonder, and the child doesn't really need to be introduced because children see naturally. Rich has been talking about this, how we start out by seeing the world, and then we start to form dogmas and doctrines and theological positions. But we first start out by being delighted by a shape and a color. I think this is a magnificent painting. They're very powerful figures, very solid. That girl is very solid and sculptural. The subject matter is washing the feet. It's a very intimate kind of scene. It's nothing very pretty, but somehow that becomes the most dignified thing that a mother could ever do to her child, is to gently wash those feet. We all came back from Holden Lake yesterday with bloody feet. We wish we had our mothers here to soothe our blisters and our achy bones. That is everybody but Thor, who's so strong. I wish I had some examples of mothers and childs that somehow don't do anything. But Mary Cassatt can take the very ordinary, the really mundane, the pedestrian foot washing and turn it into one of the grand moments in human history. And then I think this is one of the last ones. This is more impressionist. I wouldn't really call her an impressionist. She really is very classical in her interest in drawing the figure, in composing the figure. She's an impressionist in terms of the color and the way she uses paint. It's sort of lively and alive. But there's a tragedy here. I think it's a tragedy. And here I have to be amateur psychologist. And in fact, this whole idea of coming to Holden to talk about women and art makes me have to be an amateur psychologist, anthropologist, sociologist. And I'm not any of those things. I'm just somebody who knows how to get oil paint off my sweater when I get it on my sweater. That's basically where my expertise lies. But Mary Cassatt quit painting. She was very successful, very prominent. She was a bridge between European painting and American painting. And she got Americans excited about some of the modern things that were happening in Europe. But later in her 40s, she suddenly stopped. Now, being an amateur psychologist, I would say it could possibly have something to do with her moving beyond her childbearing years. And maybe this painting was a kind of vicarious participation in the act of being a mother. You might say that's nonsense. That's just a theory I developed. But there's also the problem of how do you keep yourself alive? And I think there's some of that quality that's been coming through in what Rich has been saying this week. How does the church stay alive? He keeps bringing up this image of this woman who came to the St. Louis exhibit to look at his painting of Jesus, and she said, "That's not like any Jesus I've ever seen." Suggesting, of course, that she was back there at year one. But Rich has been talking about how does the church keep its language alive? How does it respond constantly to this changing world? And certainly there's some use in tradition, in clinging to good things in the past. But there also needs to be attention with innovation and responding to the present. And there are things about our own world that are quite unique. So artists don't like to repeat themselves. They don't like to make the same painting over and over and over all of their life. And writers have the same problem. And talking with, after the concert last night, I found out that our great gift of music to Holden Village is eagerly working on his next concert. And there are all these things he has to learn before he quits. And there's this drive to keep growing and keep alive. And it doesn't matter how old we are chronologically, one has to be young. You have to keep working at this. Well, Mary Cassatt quit. And I think it's the problem of she just couldn't figure out how to keep this subject matter going. She didn't know how to work into other subjects. She made a trip to Egypt, and she was overwhelmed by the colossal strength and power of Egyptian art. And she came home determined to try to get going again, but she never did. So she built a mansion outside of Paris, a comfortable house. And she had a large garden, and she raised American corn in it. Mm-hmm. And she entertained, sort of took care of people like President Clemenceau. She was very well known in Paris. But I think that's a problem. It's a problem I struggle with. I think we all struggle with it. How do we stay alive? How do we keep growing? And she couldn't cope with that. Let's see, I've got to get on to George O'Keefe. These are two prints. They're very intimate, personal prints. This one's called The Letter. And it's an etching, which is colored. But let me move to George O'Keefe, who's a different kind of artist, who died last summer, and as far as I know, was productive and alive until the day she died, which is really amazing. And there's lots of great books on her. Well, she was 99, and she was still working. George O'Keefe was born in Wisconsin, in Trempealeau County. I don't know if there are Barron people here. That's near Trempealeau County. And her family moved to Virginia, and she got started going to school at Columbia University and went into education, and was a high school teacher in Texas. And she got in trouble with the school board because she thought there should be more to art than what the state official art curriculum called for. And I can identify with her problem. I remember in fourth grade, we were given a sheet of manila paper and a ruler, and we were told to measure over 1 inch and put a dot, and measure over another inch and put a dot. And we didn't know what we were doing this for, but I think the main point of it was to learn how to follow directions. And we did this for a week, and by the end of the week we had these dots all over this paper. And then the next week we spent connecting the dots with lines. And all of a sudden by the end of the week it became very clear that what we were making was a checkerboard. And then we were told how to make a rose, and we were given these little shapes. And if you put, first we did the green shape all the way through, and then we did the little red shapes, and sure enough it ended up looking like a rose. And somehow I blew it. I got down near the bottom and I put two roses together instead of leaving a space. So I got an F on the project. And sometimes when we were naughty, she'd say, "All right, put away your rulers. We're going to have art history." And that's why I've gotten to love this stuff so much. we had art history for punishment. And I cannot understand why I ended up in this business. Anyway, George O'Keefe was faced with the same problem. And she's a fiercely independent person. And she fought the school board. And she was interested in some modern artists. Vasily Kandinsky, a Russian artist who was working in Germany. She was interested in Paul Gauguin and some of these post-impressionists. And people like Van Gogh were interested in emotion and feeling and their own private subjectivity and the things that were deep inside of her. And so she started to invent curriculum that touched on what it's like to be a real thinking, feeling human being. And she went to Columbia University in the summer and got involved with a teacher named Arthur Dow, who had actually been a student of Paul Gauguin. And he got people started working with abstract forms, and he had them making drawings while listening to music, and I'm sure many of you have had that experience, to try to interpret the feeling of music in a formal language. These were very personal drawings. A friend of hers showed them to Alfred Stieglitz, who's the man on the left, and he had a gallery in New York, and he's the first person to really show modern art in a gallery in this country back at the beginning of the century. And he put up her exhibit of her drawings, and she was really angry because she hadn't given permission. But ultimately, they got to be good friends and they got married. And Alfred Stieglitz is really the father of modern photography in the United States. Texas and the plains of Texas always remained a very important part of her life. There's a problem here, and it's a problem a lot of women face, and it's a problem a lot of women artists face. It's the problem of reconciling her own private personal career interests in painting with those demands placed by a husband. And she struggled with this marriage problem. They did remain married throughout their life, but it was always a battle because the kinds of things he was excited about really left George O'Keefe cold. This is George O'Keefe as a little girl, and this was her high school class in Virginia. She's a very ordinary, conventional girl, but she's restless. She doesn't like this art by the numbers. She's a very handsome woman, and Alfred Stieglitz made hundreds of photographs of her and details of her hands and her head and her feet and George O'Keefe working and sewing and all kinds of intimate things that a woman might do. This is George O'Keefe. Lately, she moved to the Southwest and lived out in the desert. Alfred Stieglitz wanted her to live in New York, and they lived in a skyscraper for many years. And she thought his friends were trivial. She hated this New York society. She hated summertime in upstate New York at a lake. And she longed for her experiences around Abilene, Texas, the experience of this vast space. And finally, she discovered life in New Mexico and Arizona, out in the desert. And that's where she really found herself. And so they compromised, and she lived out there and then sometimes lived back in New York. But New York was torture. This is George O'Keefe at her ghost ranch. It's near an Indian village. She was not... she's not officially a member of a Christian church, but I think she held deep Christian convictions. And she was, except that she didn't like the lifestyle of churches. She didn't like to have to sing sad songs, and she didn't like the discipline of the church. But she was very, very close to the spiritual life of her Indian neighbors, who have a strange mixture of Christianity and their own native traditions. And she was concerned about life and death and redemption. This is at a show at the Whitney Museum recently. This is Alexander Calder, the inventor of the mobile, another old man who died shortly after this exhibit. George O'Keefe has come and gone, and she's disappeared, but since the 70s she's been very prominent. But she loved to sit out there in that burning sun and to paint this sort of deathly landscape of the desert. This is George O'Keefe at the last major show she had at the Whitney Museum. That's our local sister from Minnesota, Joan Mondale, was part of the exhibit. She was part of the... She came to pay homage to George O'Keefe. And this is a portrait of the buildings that George O'Keefe, part of her ghost ranch. Well, she could be called a modernist, but she didn't like that title. She refused to accept anybody's title. Everybody has claimed her: expressionist, surrealist, abstract expressionist, post-painterly abstract expressionist, and all those kind of post-compost, post-mistress, all those different styles, all tried to claim her. But she said, no, I'm just Georgia. And my point, my thesis, if I can get to it before the bell rings, is that while she denies a point of view that's claimed by different stylistic concepts, I think we can make some statements about a kind of feminine quality in her work. And I would maintain that the artist doesn't understand completely what he's trying to do, and that it's legitimate for us as critics within certain limitations to help the artist understand what he or she is trying to do. It's important for us to interpret the work of art, because the creative process is such a dynamic process when it's really clicking. Paint, values, biography, history, society, community, America, France, or whatever, all these things roll up together. You can't separate them out. And when you are really working well, you're surprised by what you do. You step back after you're done and you say, did I do that? I can't believe it. So I think that's an indication that maybe some of the things that she's talking about, that she denies she's talking about, it's legitimate for us to say something about that. So these are some things that she did when she was in New York, and it's typical of the art of late, the second decade of the century, and the first, and the 20s. It's an example of American modernism, and I won't go into a definition of cubism, but American painting tends to be very realistic, and so it's always working with a subject matter, but the forms might be very simple, highly simplified and geometric. Certainly, the way she uses the light up at the top is a rather subjective kind of addition to this landscape. But so many of her early paintings dealt with the city and city skyscrapers. I think she really was bored by this kind of environment and this approach to modern art. In the desert, she found nature. And this is a rather conventional portrait, a very small painting of a lily, but she goes into it with great detail. She paints very cleanly. She has perfectly designed contours. She usually works with a wonderful sense of light. These are double lilies. These are cactus blossoms. And this is a very large painting, much bigger than the image on the screen. So she started to work with microcosmic nature, and she blew these forms up until they almost became undistinguishable as you get close to painting. All you really see is this wonderful vocabulary of forms and shapes. And these sort of strange spaces behind the petals, places that you can go into and investigate. And she painted very smoothly and cleanly. I'm sure that she learned something from her photographer husband, but I would like to think that she taught photography more than she learned from photography. I think there's a dialogue going on here, but I think it was her curiosity about living, breathing, growing things that first got her started in this, and she taught the photographers how to see the same kind of thing. This is an orchid blossom, and it's very large, and it almost is hard to figure out what it is. Because of the way she moves in so closely on the forms, I'm suggesting that there's a highly erotic quality to her art. And she says, that's hogwash. She says, if you find my work sexy, that's all in your mind. And it's not certainly not in my mind. And she was really upset by that implication that what she was doing was exploring the extravagant, erotic advertising campaign of nature. And its seductive colors and forms, and its invitation to come in and be a part of these internal spaces. But it seems to me, maybe it's just my male point of view, but it seems to me that that's a lot of what these paintings are about. The black iris seems to me to be a highly erotic kind of image, which a flower is, and which is certainly part of the whole natural order of things. But she moves in closely on the iris and paints the rhythms and this dark secret space right there in the center of the painting. Her paintings tend to be symmetrical. There's an axis right down the center. They tend to be very frontal. That is, everything's parallel with the picture plane. They're large paintings, large as the image on the screen. They're immaculately painted with a great deal of care and precision. This is an abstraction. It's simply called an abstract painting, and probably it relates to sand dunes and to the forms that she finds out there in the Southwest. But there's also that dark space in the middle. And I think that dark space is an opening into some internal space. And I think one is invited to come into that space. And it's that quality that I would suggest is uniquely feminine about her work. And it grows out of her own biology, her own physiognomy, if that's the right word. And maybe it's an unconscious projection of her own physical nature as a woman. But that's the way I would read those forms, and she would say, "You're nothing but a dirty old man." And that's probably true, but I think it's legitimate. And I'll say more about that. This is a relationship of a geometric form, a black rectangle, in the midst of these organic shapes. And I don't know exactly what feeling she was after. These are the kinds of things she got her students to do, to play with forms and shapes and rhythms in an attempt to get into their own subjectivity. And I think she's doing the same kind of thing. And I would call this contrast, in a sense, a masculine-feminine kind of contrast. Maybe here I'm simply adding to the stereotype notions about what it means to be masculine, what it means to be feminine. But let me show some more. There's a kind of an obsessive image that appears in a lot of her paintings, the window. And it's a very symmetrical painting. This was at her cottage at Lake George in upstate New York when she spent a lot of time there. The window is an opening to a room. It's an interior space, but we don't know what's going on in that room. There's a great deal of ambiguity about that inner space. Maybe it's even confusing. It certainly lacks a reason for why it's there. And there's that strange shape hanging in the window. Is that the door on the back of the room? Is that inviting us into another chamber, deeper and deeper into the inner space of this painting? This is a window in her adobe building, a doorway. And she looks through it, and there's that shadow. And then we go beyond, and we go through another window, and we go into another room, and into another space. I think I would like to talk about O'Keeffe's paintings as participatory paintings. They demand our participation. They demand that we enter into these spaces. They demand that we become a part of her subjectivity. Her method of painting is very clean and objective and in a sense detached, but what she's really talking about is the secret inner life of things. And maybe that's just the secret inner life of nature, but maybe it's about her own subjectivity, and maybe it's about her own femininity. This is called pink and blue music, and it seems to be a cloud-like form, and we seem to be looking up into infinity, into the sky. And I would say that there's a very wonderful spiritual quality here as we engage, in a sense, with infinity, which is incomprehensible, which we cannot nail down. She did a series of paintings of a bone that she picked up in the desert. This is a pelvis bone. And she looked at things through that hole in the pelvis bone. And it is this organic shape that keeps coming through. And it's a space that invites us in and asks us to come into that deep blue infinity, that deep blue mystery, surrounded by this very cleanly painted shape. Let's see, I'm a professional and I never show a slide on its side or upside down, but I just blew it. This is a black pear, and the black pear should be at the top of the painting with a shadow at the bottom. And in a sense, it's the reverse of this painting. This is a negative shape, and this is a positive shape. And it's a positive form. It's a fruit, and it's a fruit filled with seeds. And it's a fertile form. It's a pregnant form. It's a form that will give new life. And I think that's kind of wonder about that mystery of just new life is a constant theme in her work. And in many ways, then, George O'Keeffe is talking about the same thing that Mary Cassatt talked about in this intimate relationship of a mother and a child. A little digression here. This is a young sculptor named Alice Acock, featured on the cover of Art News magazine. And Alice Acock, on her mother's farm, made this large construction, a labyrinth, a maze. And a maze, a labyrinth is something that you can't understand. And you might get lost in there, but you have to go in and you have to find your way through that form. And the labyrinth is an image of ambiguity. It's an image of mystery. It's incomprehensible. When you get there, you don't know how you got there. But you never can remain outside of this piece or you'll miss the whole point of it. You have to come in, you have to be a part of it, you have to be a participant. You have to work your way through those spaces. I think we could call this a feminine image. the maze or the labyrinth is a very unclear image. And it stands in opposition to the pyramid, the Egyptian pyramid. Imagine that form. We could call that a masculine form. And you stay outside of the pyramid. You don't go into it. You're not supposed to climb on it. You're not supposed to be a part of it. It stands there as an inert physical fact. It's absolutely clear. It's absolutely physical. There's no ambiguity about it. You don't really participate with it. You can take it or leave it. But the labyrinth demands involvement, engagement, participation, caring, desire, eroticism, if you will. All of these are elements that come into play in entering into this space. This becomes the perfect image of the feminine experience. And I think that's what George O'Keefe is talking about. This is Alice Aycock, a series of underground interconnecting tunnels. They're both forbidding, they're both frightening. They could be defensive structures, they could be missile structures. You get down in there and maybe you're snooping around in your grandmother's basement, you're a little bit terrified, but it's sort of fun. She builds these kinds of enclosures. This is a space surrounded by a wall. To get to the roof of the other one, you have to leap. You might fall and break your leg. And if you make it, you crawl down in and you go inside. And there are other kinds of chambers and rooms inside of this space. A young woman of Chinese descent won the competition to design the Vietnam Memorial. Her name is Maya Ying Lin. She was 21 years old. She got an assignment in her class at Yale to enter this competition. She won the competition. Her teacher gave her a B for her project. Her teacher also entered the competition. It was a class in landscape architecture, and he was rejected. Maya Ying Ling made a very controversial work. It's a dark, black, V-shaped incision in the ground. And in order to get anything out of it, you have to walk into the ground. And it's a spatial-temporal experience. The first person to die in Vietnam is listed at the center vertical crack in this monument. And then the names are recorded in the order in which the deaths were reported, and you work your way to the left. And then you go back to the middle, or you go back to the outside and the other side and work your way back to the middle, but when you get to the middle, you start all over again. So it's a list of names without beginning or ending. And in order to find your son's name, your brother's name, your father's name, you have to go through this agonizing spatial-temporal experience. And as we all know, this is having a devastating effect on some veterans. But it's a piece of modern art, a piece of modern sculpture. It's not quite marble. It doesn't seem dignified. It doesn't seem noble. It seems funereal. But it's a space that goes into the ground. And we do things in the ground. We bury seeds, they die, and they're reborn. We bury dead birds. We bury people. And Maya Ying Lin wanted us to move into the ground. And, she says she's not being political because that was part of the requirement of the competition. But it is political, obviously. It's not in any way celebrating war or victory or heroes. It's just talking about this solemn, tragic event. But to get back to George O'Keefe, I think the main point of it is that you have to enter into the ground. You have to enter into this space. You have to be a part of this spatial-temporal experience. And at one of the arms of the memorial relates to the George Washington Monument. And that's like a pyramid. It's just a physical fact. It's standing there. It's not doing anything. You don't relate to it. You just walk around it. You don't go into it. It's clear and strong and powerful. And it's a symbol of American bigness and power. And in a sense, Maya Ying Ling's work obviously is extending out and is acting as a strong contrast to the Washington Memorial. I might also call Maya's work a feminine work, and the George Washington work a masculine work. And it seems to me that the feminine work has had a greater impact on all of us than the Washington Monument ever did. It just gets us tired out when we try to climb all the steps. It's a controversial work. Ross Perot tried to junk it. I think there was opposition to it partly because Maya Ying Lin is not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. There's opposition to it because she's a woman. There's opposition to it because she's 21 years old, and we know that 21-year-old kids can't do anything. They can't make supper, they can't drive buses, they can't run this Holden Village. So, to conclude with George O'Keefe, these are lilies. Again, I think there's this quality of eros about this work. Eros involves desire. Desire involves union. Union involves relationship. Relationship involves community. These are all very important factors. They involve participation. But participation is dangerous. Because if you invite somebody to come and participate in something, you don't really have a lot of control over them. The George Washington Monument repels us. We're not invited to participate with it. So it stands there as an authority over us. But the Vietnam Memorial demands our participation, and there's been a lot of trouble because of that. Just a couple more slides. This is the Jack in the Pulpit series. She's really excited about, intrigued with, the secret inner growing life of forms in nature. Part of this Jack in the Pulpit series, just looking at the rhythms and shapes of these unfolding forms as they reveal their secret inner life. I think that might be the last one. No, this is a canna lily. Usually there's a center of some kind with these forms resolving around it. Oh, the last slides are, this is a bleeding heart, but the last works are of her landscape. A skull that she found on a post painted against a red, white, and blue background. She claims all she wanted to do was make the great American painting, so she had to put red, white, and blue in it. But I think we're entitled to have thoughts about death and resurrection and about sky and all those kinds of things. And I'm not going to let George O'Keefe say her paintings aren't about anything, because they seem, they touch me deeply, like Ravel did last night. And I really appreciate the care of her seeing, the care of her drawing, the design, and the way she really enters into the life of nature, of the created order. There are these strange visions of forms that she found in her desert landscape. And I'm sure if you lived out there under that sun long enough, you'd start seeing things. Before she died, she tried to give a lot of her paintings to the state of Arizona and New Mexico, and they wouldn't accept it. Peter Hurd is the norm, and if it doesn't look like Peter Hurd, it's not art. And so her work was given away to other institutions. These are the last paintings. She loved this burnt, eroded southwestern landscape. She loved those layers. I've hiked in this country with a geologist who's explained the meaning of all these layers. But this was a great ocean, and you sort of recall that prehistory as you look at these paintings. This is a watercolor looking in the canyons, delicate colors of the canyons. And this is the last painting. I saw a film of George O'Keefe, and she's standing talking about this little gully. And then she shows the painting. This is what she saw. And again, it's this axial, symmetrical painting with this opening in the earth. And I think all the forms, I like the forms in the Black Iris, they're forms that invite us into the inside of the earth. Maybe they invite us into death, maybe they invite us into life, who knows what's in there. But I think those are the kinds of questions and interests that this fascinating woman had. I think that's the end.